Hey, colleagues, welcome back to the office. It's Steve. Welcome to episode 23 of the CPE Today podcast, and welcome to our presentation. This is Critical Tips for Avoiding Identity Theft and Data Breaches, Part 2. In this presentation, we are going to be looking and continuing our discussion on information theft, data breaches, identity theft, all things around security and privacy to help make ourselves, our organizations, and our companies more secure. In this presentation for today, we're going to be taking a deeper look at data breaches, how they occur, and some specific attack types that might be of risk for your specific organizations. So we're going to be looking at different things such as application attacks. More and more of us are utilizing cloud-based resources, you know, such as enterprise resource planning, websites, CRM systems, so on and so forth, that are susceptible to certain types of attacks. So what are they and how can we protect ourselves from them? On the larger side, we have things such as distributed denial of service. You might have heard of this as a DDoS attack. Okay, what is it? How does it occur? Additionally, some more commonplace applications can also be compromised as well, including point-of-sale services and other software, hardware that we might have inside of our system, using techniques such as malware, ransomware, and more. So we're going to talk about through what those different types of attack types are and what you could do to help prevent them from occurring inside of your organization. We're also going to discuss a couple of different examples, some case studies where data breaches were used to have a negative effect on an organization, which resulted in a loss. There are two that come to mind. They're a little bit older than I would like, but they really illustrate the concept well. One was where they used essentially a brute force attack to attempt to steal intellectual property from a company based in Florida. And another one is kind of a really interesting example where they used a myriad of different types of attack to ultimately compromise a company's bank and then steal significant assets from that organization. And so the intention with this is to kind of show you how these different attack types can be used in combination with each other to compromise an organization, to steal data, to steal money, to steal whatever else might be needed. In the second part of our presentation, we're going to focus more on best practices. We're going to talk about different ways of keeping our organization safe and secure. We're going to talk about common network appliances such as firewalls, intrusion detection, prevention, as well as password protection and more. We're going to hit as many of these as we can. And we're also going to finish with a discussion of how modern internet browsers are doing the heavy lifting with respect to keeping your information safe and secure. Additionally, to the actual browser, whether you're using Chrome, Firefox, Edge, or Opera, or another one, how we can improve the overall security by utilizing a third-party privacy tool such as uBlock Origin. And we'll talk about what that is and why that is an effective tool for helping reduce your organizational risk and exposure. So all that and more in today's CPE Today podcast. So lots to come. Now, I do want to remind you, if you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, you can earn credit for watching or listening to today's podcast. It's super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com. Use course code IDT2. You take a quick, short 5-question exam, and you will earn a credit for today's class. It's super simple. It's affordable. It's easy. It's a great way to earn credits so that you can stay on top of your continuing education. And you can earn it in as little as about 2 minutes. So if you are a financial professional, please check us out. Again, that is cpetoday.com. Use course code IDT2. Alrighty, let's go ahead and dive into the first part of our presentation for today, which is going to be discussion of data breach patterns. This information itself is coming from a report that's put together annually from Verizon, which I'll talk about here in a minute. And this is a small subsection of that report. And what we're going to be focusing on today are the patterns in terms of some of the common things that we see with respect to data breaches and some of the common attack vectors that occur. These are common not only inside of Fortune 500 companies, but certainly ma and pa shops, nonprofits, government agencies as well. And some of these attack types are going to be more susceptible to your organization than others. You know, for example, if you don't have point of sale, well, you'd probably don't have that attack vector, you know, but if you have some sort of software, some sort of application. Well, guess what? You probably do have web application attacks. So not every one of these are going to apply to your specific organization and use case, but it's good to have a good idea of what attack types are out there so that you can find the correct manner of protecting your organization and the correct way of reducing your risk. So there's about, I would say, 7 or 8 of these that we're going to go through today. And I'm going to try to share my experience, my work, and my thoughts on this to hopefully help you reduce your organizational risk. Now, the information that I'm sharing is coming from a fabulous report. This report is called the Verizon's Data Breach Investigations Report. The Verizon DBR report is a report that is put together annually from Verizon. That is a report that kind of looks at the major data breaches that have occurred over the last couple of years, months, and try to essentially come up with the different themes that have happened, as well as some of the different audiences that were specifically at risk. It analyzes these breaches. They try to give you the information necessary to understand what essentially occurred, and then more importantly, to make effective decisions about how you can reduce your organizational's risk in the future. It's put together primarily by Verizon, but co-authors include the Secret Service, the FBI, and about 200 other law enforcement agencies around the world. And in my opinion, it's definitely the most comprehensive security report out there. And it's a report that I definitely take a look at every single year. One of my favorite things about this report is that it provides detailed threat analysis to about 15 major industries that are out there, from healthcare, education, manufacturing, professional, and more. And what I like about this is that it gives us the information for our specific industry to know, hey, what's on the horizon? What are some of the things that we should be considering? And what are some of the things that we should be preparing ourselves for as major attack types in the coming year? This report is free, and you can just download it by going to Verizon's website. Let's go ahead and take a quick look at this just so you can kind of see this report and where it comes from. Best case, just go ahead and Google Verizon DBIR. This report, I'm going to say, comes out annually around August or so. So the most recent one we have is from 2020. Okay. Now the report comes in a couple of different varieties. The big report is about 400 pages of technical analysis and insight with respect to, you know, everything that has occurred over the last year. But for those of you who maybe aren't maybe that are interested in security, but don't necessarily want to read a 500-page report, check out this executive summary that they have right here. In this brief, if you click down here to view only, you can go ahead and read the nice, very summarized, about 20 pages of this actual report itself. And so it goes away with some of the key takeaways, some of the specific highlights for different industries. And it also has a specific focus on SMB. So if you're a small, medium business, they've got stuff for you as well. It's not just a Fortune 500, big business kind of a thing. You know, and so what I like about this, you know, just to kind of peruse from the get-go, it gives us an idea of trends that are occurring. And if you've attended any of the other CPE Today podcasts, you know I'm a big fan of trends and where the industry are going. And some of these trends are really important to know, like who are the victims and who are behind the breaches, and what type of attacks were utilized, you know, because the odds of you falling into one of these circumstances in one of these categories are pretty high itself. Now, coming back over here, you can also dive into some of the analysis of this, and you can start getting some insight with respect to industries that might be of specific interest to you. You know, so if you're running a hotel, or if you've got a theater, you're running a construction company, maybe you have a school or a mine or a retail organization, they've got information specific to you, which is what I really, really like. You know, so I'm going to share with you some of the main insights that are coming from this report. And we plan on doing this every year as this report comes out so that you have some good idea with respect to what to start preparing yourself for in the coming year. Okay, so we are going to be looking at the patterns. These are some of the things that we see that are major occurrences inside of the industry. Okay, and so I've got about maybe, there's about 10 or so that are majorly discussed inside of that report. We're going to look at probably about 6 to 8 inside of this. I picked the ones that I think are going to be most interest to our audience here. Now, I want to start off with point of sale, POS, okay? Now, point of sale is the computer terminal when you go to check out at the supermarket or you go to ring up a purchase at a retail. It's the computer, essentially, that essentially facilitates that sale. You know, when you're going to buy food at Kroger, at Safeway, at Whole Foods, wherever you happen to buy that, the thing that they're checking you out on essentially is a computer. It runs Windows, most likely, and it's connected to a network. And if you have this type of technology inside of your organization, this is something that you should be concerned with because these particular systems are so susceptible for compromise. And most likely inside of your organization, this would be the thing that would be of most risk to your organization. And the reason being is that it involves credit cards, okay? And what the attackers are essentially trying to do is they're trying to compromise the machine to get a copy of that credit card that is being swiped by the customer. It usually involves tampering or swapping out either a physical device, such as the actual credit card reader itself. And this is very common, for example, in restaurants. They'll, for example, have a reader that they will take an imprint of the card and then they will ring up the sale as normal. But it could also, for example, include compromising of the actual computer system that runs the point of sale itself. Now, generally, point of sale attacks, thankfully, are trending down over the last couple of years. However, when they do occur, they can be quite harmful. I'm reminded, for example, of the Target data breach in the later part of the last decade, or in before that, the Home Depot, and there's certainly been others there. And so one of the things that I will tell you with this is that with respect to your point of sale system, just realize that if you have this inside your organization, this is probably the thing you need to be the most concerned about. And reducing access to this particular system, hardening the software and security procedures around this particular system, like the server, the network, is probably one of the best things that you can do. Okay. Now, people who are most susceptible to this, again, are people with point of sale. So restaurants, hotels, grocery stores, any other sort of brick and mortar retailers. Now, one of the best things that you could possibly do is to eliminate point of sale, but obviously that's not a possibility for a lot of different organizations. But if you haven't upgraded your point of sale system in the last, let's say, 10 years, it's probably time to consider doing that. And in fact, if we look at some of the requirements for PCI compliance, PCI compliance is the industry standards for security, for managing credit cards inside of an organization. You know, you might not be in compliance, and that's a big risk for your organization. You know, because if a data breach occurs and financial information is stolen or compromised, you could be held liable for that particular loss. Now, if you already have a point of sale system and it's up to date, here are some other general best practices you should follow. Definitely restrict remote access to this, and as much as possible, run it on a separate network. Point of sale, you know, it can run on the normal network of your office or of your store, but you could also put it onto a separate network. It could still use the same internet connection to process credit cards, but you could run what we call a VLAN. A VLAN is a virtual LAN. You know, a single Ethernet cable doesn't just carry one network. It can carry multiple networks inside of it. So one of the best practices is that we put the credit card terminals and the point of sale terminals on a separate network, thereby reducing risk. Certainly, eliminating any sort of wireless access to non-point of sale devices. Not saying you couldn't have a remote terminal, but make sure that the only devices on that network are point of sale devices. That's a great way of reducing risk. There's been examples of data breaches that have occurred where they've ultimately gotten into the point of sale system, but because the point of sale system used a network that was also used for other data traffic, well, they didn't compromise the point of sale directly. They compromised the other devices in the network and then ultimately found their way in. So best practice, remove remote access, only allow point of sale devices on that actual computer. Password policies certainly apply, and certainly try to keep it as limited as you possibly can. Now, if you don't have point of sale system, you probably have other systems inside your business. Most companies now are operating upwards of a dozen or more different applications inside their business. And depending on the nature of your business, you could easily have more than that. And different businesses will, for example, have things like enterprise resource planning, ERP. They might have customer resource management, CRM. They might have an accounting system. They might have a custom database. They might have an e-commerce portal. Anything around those ultimately can be compromised, okay? And when we compromise these systems, they're typically compromised at either the provider level, or if they're being run on-premise, they're being compromised at the server level. And we would call these a web application attack, okay? Web applications are great targets because generally they can be accessed worldwide. You know, if I've got, for example, a portal system inside of my business that is available to my customers, well, that means it's probably also available to people around the world. As such, I could be an attacker in a coffee shop in Istanbul, or I could be sitting on a beach in the Bahamas, and I can access this potential system just like a customer would. Okay. And what they ultimately try to do is they try to find vulnerabilities. Okay. This is a throwback to what we were talking about in our data disaster class earlier this year. Vulnerabilities are inherent in every application. They are weaknesses in the actual design of the application itself. And when those vulnerabilities get found, we call that an exploit. And ultimately, these attackers are looking for vulnerable code to find exploits to ultimately get around the security mechanisms in a specific application. So it doesn't matter if you're using a software title from a major publisher or you built it yourself, all applications have vulnerabilities that just haven't been discovered yet. Now, these attacks usually occur in two ways. You know, typically what they will do is they'll find that vulnerability and then they will exploit a weakness in that application, usually some sort of data validation. Okay. Second, they will use stolen credentials to impersonate a user. And so many attacks and so many compromises occur just from credentials being stolen and being used by the person that was not assigned to those. Now, in the first type, what we're talking about finding a weakness application, this could be, for example, scanning the network. It could be looking for open ports. It could be looking for weak or limited security mechanisms for a particular thing. You know, if we look, for example, and going back in time to one of the worst data breaches that ever occurred, which was the Equifax data breach in 2017, this is 100% how this occurred. Likewise, if we go back a little bit further, Sony had a major data breach that brought down the PlayStation Network as well as their motion picture studios. Well, guess what? That ultimately started from a web application on the exterior, on the edge of their network being compromised. Now, they will scan for these particular applications. They will specifically look to see if they've been updated or not updated. And then if they are not updated, they will ultimately try to compromise this through a variety of techniques, including brute force, as well as looking for known vulnerabilities that have not been updated. You know, so you've heard me preach about this several times, the importance of update inside of your network, all devices, every single one of them, from the switches and routers and modems and printers to the computers and servers themselves need to be updated. Now, a common attack with respect to exploiting this is what we call SQL injection. Okay. And this comes from putting malicious code like database statements, SQL standing for structured query language, in a web page input. And you can, on a poorly designed web application, put in code and the computer will see that that code has been inputted. Imagine you put in some sort of malicious code in the, you know, name field or the password field when you're signing up for an account on a particular service. Well, the computer would see that and would execute this. Now, thankfully, most applications have been hardened to protect this particular attack, but older applications certainly are vulnerable to this as well. This can become cause the database to become corrupted or breached itself. And you can do things from dropping tables, removing tables, or even resetting passwords. So SQL injection is one of the most common types of web application attacks. It's been around forever. And even though it's been around forever, this is still a major risk for a lot of organizations. Now, if you're interested more about SQL, check out some of our data courses from CP Today. We've got a number of courses already out and more coming on the way talking about how databases work, and a little bit of fundamental knowledge about how databases operate can really help you in this particular circumstance. Now, some recommendations. Best recommendation by far, always, 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 always keep your systems up to date. If you're going to build software inside your organization, please just realize that it is a never-ending process. An application that is built in 2014 has to be updated in 2015 and 2016, so on and so forth. If you put an application out there, 5 years later, guaranteed it will be breached at some point. So for organizations that are looking to build software, and you should, I mean, it's not a bad thing to consider building unique software for your organization. It can massively improve operations, but just realize it is an ongoing effort. And I've worked with multiple different organizations over the years that built something, let it kind of lull, let it kind of lapse, only to find themselves in a very precarious situation 5 years later, whether it be, hey, we need to update this to meet current business objectives, and also, sadly, hey, we need to update this because we have a massive issue that could potentially cause our data to be stolen. So update is the best thing that you can do. Now, if you're building from scratch at the moment, you need to implement very good identity confirmation services and authentication. You should, for example, create strong passwords that are hashed and salted. If you're not familiar with those terms, they're authentication techniques that ensure that if a database is encrypted, that, you know, that one encrypted device can't cause all the passwords to be displayed if it is compromised. It is a really effective security technique that is built into most modern application frameworks. And certainly if you're building things, you want to validate and test this. Validate the input, strip out, for example, anything that could potentially corrupt on the server or could be interpreted as code on a user input. You want to enforce lockout policies for passwords to prevent things like brute force. Even, for example, limiting the rate to maybe only one password a second is enough to thwart most attacks. Likewise, 5 bad passwords locks you out for maybe 5 minutes or requires a reset by email. Okay. Also, monitor your connections in terms of who can connect and what they're doing. And a best practice for any authentication is to require 2-factor or 1-time passwords. More on that here in a little bit. Now, amazingly, a number of attacks occur due to the staff itself. So a lot of incidents have occurred either through staff maliciously or accidentally exposing credentials. We'll talk about more about physical error, or not physical errors, but errors and omissions here in a little bit. But we need to be conscious about staff themselves. Okay, a lot of incidents have occurred when there have been unapproved or malicious use of organizational resources by the people that we choose to employ. Okay, these people, for example, might be an administrator in the system. They might be a senior staff. They might be an executive. They might be a director. Well, guess what? They're typically going to have privileged access into our systems. That's normal. That's what they do for their particular job. Okay, well, what happens if they use that level of access to steal information from the company? Well, we would typically call that fraud, and as well as certainly a violation of the fiduciary obligations of that person. Now, people who are knowledge workers are usually the focus of this. You can't steal what you don't have access to. So this isn't really particular a risk, for example, for, you know, your store clerks and your low-level staffers, your warehouse staff, but this is going to be more at the risk of the director, the CEO, CFO, things of this nature. It's certainly by industry as well. People in public, like government agencies, real estate, administrative, transportation, manufacturing, as well as professional services and financial firms are definitely the most at risk. Now, in these particular instances, this is almost always for some sort of economic gain, either directly or indirectly. It could be, for example, taking insider information and then buying or selling or shorting a particular stock because we know additional information for that. Or it could, for example, be that a certain person is leaving a company and they want to take trade secrets, whether they be manufacturing techniques, intellectual property, customer lists, or things of this nature. And they could be taking it to start their own organization or helping to secure employment with a rival organization. I remember reading a news article about a couple years ago, and I think it was between two major yogurt companies, of all things. And a senior executive from one yogurt company was leaving and going to another yogurt company and was taking privileged information with them. Well, I mean, as funny as that sounds, the fact that it's yogurt, I mean, how sensitive could this possibly be? Well, I mean, to a company that maybe sells, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars of merchandise, well, yeah, that could be a pretty big deal. Now, I'm also reminded, and this is a couple years further back, probably the most notable example of insider privilege misuse would be Edward Snowden. Okay, so Edward Snowden, if you're not familiar with him, was a contractor for the consulting company Booz Allen Hamilton, and he worked for the NSA, the National Security Administration here in the National Security Agency here in the United States. He was and had access to very sensitive information inside of the U.S. government. And he specifically was working with a program that allowed him to have access to really kind of top secret programs that the government was doing around surveillance. The specifics of this, I'm not going to, pass judgment on. That's for you to decide yourself. The intention of this is to really kind of show that he was in a privileged position. He had access to sensitive information. In this case, it was about a program called PRISM. And he stole that information. And then he ultimately made it public. And it's been a big thing ever since. He essentially is a fugitive from justice living in Russia at the time of this recording. Now, it's important to note, Edward did not hack. He did not compromise. He did not brute force or otherwise write malware that could compromise in this case, the NSA's computer system. He was a person who had employment with them, who had access to this particular information. He walked in with a thumb drive and walked out with over 200,000 documents just in the palm of his hand. This particular type of risk has been around forever. It's been around, literally since commerce has occurred. However, people were either limited to what they could carry in their head or the number of physical papers that they could walk out with. Edward took, again, I think it was like 200,000 documents. I mean, if this had occurred in the 90s or earlier, well, guess what? He'd probably be wheeling it out, in a wheelbarrow or maybe needing, a couple of U-Haul trucks to move that amount of paper. Well, now, through the miracle of technology, through a thumb drive, I can take that quantity of data and just slip it into my pocket. So be conscious of this, in the fact that you should have systems, for example, that will log who has accessed what files, when they were last modified, and also being able to implement control lists inside the organization about who can read, who can write, who can download, who can modify, who can delete those particular files. It's not that the government didn't have those particular things. It's just I don't think they thought that that could occur to them. So my recommendations for you, know who has access to your data, review those accounts, watch for data thefts, regularly review and overview your particular logs to ensure that people aren't accessing these things irregularly. Modern software applications such as QuickBooks and others will have audit logs. Likewise, most document management systems will have audit logs that will show you chronologically when a document was created, when it was edited or modified, downloaded, sent to particular people. That information can be invaluable when you're trying to piece together when a data breach occurred and whether or not something was accessed when it should not have been. Physical loss and theft still occurs a lot. In this particular instance, this is when a information asset goes missing, whether either through misplacement or malice. As a guy pre-COVID who traveled a lot, I'm thankful in the sense that I thankfully never had a briefcase or something stolen, but I've seen the lost and found in an airport, and they're often littered certainly with luggage, but certainly a number of backpacks and briefcases. And I think about all those computers for all those different people that are in there. At the very best, it's just misplaced and it'll get back to you at some point. But losing a computer, losing a device, even a cell phone, for example, now is so powerful. It can contain millions of records for your organization, can pose a significant risk. And depending on where you live, it could represent a data breach. And it could also represent something that would require you to notify either government or state and local municipalities, or certainly your customers, that their data might have been lost or stolen. Any organizations that are specifically dealing with data, like healthcare, public organizations, manufacturing, professional service firms, financial service firms, are particularly susceptible for this. Okay. Now, loss is reported a lot more than theft. I feel that, you know, when people lose something, they obviously want to try to get it back. But if it's theft, obviously that presents a whole nother set of risks. So I'm willing to bet a lot of this actually goes unreported. So I bet there's a lot more than we actually know about. Now, the stuff that does get reported, thankfully, in 2020 and 2021 and going forward, we have these disclosure laws that have to be out there. And so it varies depending on where you live, what constitutes a data breach, but just realize that physical loss and theft definitely could fall inside of that, umbrella of occurrences. Now, what's interesting is that more theft occurs at the corporate office than assets in the actual possession of the employees. So typically we will see, for example, more theft occur, you know, where we are doing our work than from our cars or homes, although that is certainly something to consider. And we're talking specifically about corporate assets, corporate computers, corporate phones, things of this nature. Now, my best recommendation for you is to encrypt your devices and keep sensitive information with you, back it up, lock it down. In a lot of states, there are safe harbor provisions that if a device is lost or stolen, if it is encrypted, it does not constitute a data breach. You're going to want to check your local regulations to see, you know, if that particularly applies to you, but that does in several states here in the United States. And certainly it's going to vary depending outside of the United States as well. Europe has GDPR, the General Data and Protection Regulations. You're definitely going to want to familiarize yourself with this in this year and going forward, because this is increasingly becoming more important. But if a device is encrypted, the reason we don't need to necessarily worry about it is that unless the user has the decryption key, that device essentially is inaccessible. You know, modern encryption algorithms, including AES 256 and higher, are so secure and so robust that you could have literally until the end of time and you would not be able to access that particular device. That's assuming you have a good, strong password. Additionally, you might want to consider, for example, for your mobile devices, instituting tracking. I can tell you for like iPhones and Androids, you can have a service that essentially that if the device is lost or stolen, you can track it. On iPhones, which is the platform I'm more familiar with, they have the Find My iPhone app, which allows you to be able to track down a lost phone, computer, or tablet, and it'll give you on a map exactly where that is. And that's incredibly useful, mostly just because I seem to misplace it around the house all the time. But I have had to, on unfortunate circumstances, you know, where a device was stolen. That happened to me a couple of years ago at a very large concert. I've had it similarly with family members who have left it at a restaurant, not to find it when they go back to go looking for it. What's nice about that is that you can send a kill command to that device remotely, triggering a service which will essentially reformat that device, wiping all the data from it. Well, that's a great way of reducing your risk. As unfortunate as it might be to lose what seemingly now are increasingly expensive phones, like, you know, on the new iPhone, I think is like $1,500. As much as that is unfortunate, we've got insurance that'll usually compensate. And certainly, you know, losing the phone is one thing, but potentially having a data breach for your organization is another. That's a small price to pay. A lot of organizations are still susceptible to errors. This happens all the time, and it is a major problem for everybody. We've all fat fingered something and accidentally sent an email to somebody we didn't intend. We've all probably accidentally forwarded something we shouldn't have forwarded. We probably accidentally opened up a file for sharing on the web that we forgot about, you know, and didn't turn around and, you know, basically make it private at some point. Errors occur, and these could be unintentional errors, human error, or they could be due to some sort of process, you know, that essentially is so mundane and repetitive that we just kind of zone out and it just occurs. Most of the time, errors are errors. You know, they are what they are. They're just mistakes. But this still happens a lot. anybody who's dealing with data, dealing with customer information. So our government organizations are hugely responsible for a lot of this, as well as organizations that are knowledge-based, firms, accounting organizations, financial service firms, certainly, you know, anybody who is working with a computer at some point will fat finger something and make a mistake. So this could most often result in misdelivery of documents, publishing errors, and disposal errors, and other issues inside the system. Now, there are some different ways that we can do this. First and foremost, I like to say, you know, you can do about 50 minutes of work and then you need to step away for a bit. You know, I'm not really good at that. So do as I say, not as I do, but realize that regular breaks throughout the day can be very effective in improving the overall quality of the work that you are doing. Additionally, at an organizational level, we can implement different technologies to help reduce the risk. One of those technologies is a technology called DLP, or data loss prevention. DLP is something, for example, baked into Office 365. Okay. And I'm saying Office 365 intentionally. The higher levels of the 365 platform, okay, the E3 and E5 plans include a technology called DLP. This will scan the data inside of your 365 account in transit. It will scan it and rest, specifically looking for data that could potentially be compromised and stolen. You know, for example, customer accounts, social security numbers, credit card numbers, checking account, things of this nature. And it will also monitor as things are moving through the network. So, you know, accidentally sending something that might have a bunch of sensitive information could be caught by this technology, and it can prevent it from ever leaving. We use this, for example, in our company, Devmatics, to look at various important data from a customer perspective. And if you try to, for example, forward a document that had a bunch of social security numbers in it, that DLP technology is going to stop it. So you should also ensure that all technology disposals go through the IT team before leaving. Okay. So if you're going to get rid of a computer, get rid of a server, get rid of a printer, whatever it ends up being, you should definitely involve the IT team. Quick story. This happened many, many, many years ago. I was still working in public accounting, and we at the firm wanted to get a new printer. So I contacted another company that dealt in secondhand printers, scanners, and things of this nature. And we bought this really cool Ricoh all-in-one device. Okay. It also had a network scanner on it. Okay. I get the device back to the office, get it all polished up, connect it, start looking through it. Holy smokes. There are years of scanned documents inside of this machine. Well, it turns out that device was in a law office prior to coming to our office. And I don't think they realized that when they scanned something and sent it to themselves by email, the machine also took a copy of that and stored it on an internal hard drive. I don't think they would have disposed of this device if they had known that, or at least would have wiped the hard drive. That's pretty common. Realize that almost every device in the network now has some measure of storage inside of it, and it can be incredibly small. So when you're disposing of something, make sure it is wiped. Go through, reset all factory settings, make sure that you wipe that hard drive or device inside of it so that the next person who has it doesn't wind up with your organization's data. Okay, so that is pretty common, and just realize just pretty much every device now has some measure of storage. Alrighty, let's go ahead and have a review question. Alrighty, so our first review question here, which is not a recommendation for securing a point of sale system in your network? Is it put that system on a separate network? Nope, you definitely want to put that system on a separate network or a separate VLAN. Do you want to restrict remote access? Yes, you definitely want to do that. Ensuring that people can't access remotely will be very helpful, reducing your risk and exposure. Is it keeping software up to date? Yes, you certainly want to do that as well. The correct answer in terms of what you don't want to do is allow non-commerce activities on those computers and devices. Your point of sale is for point of sale only, and that is just about it. Alrighty, so let's go ahead and get back to our presentation here and look at our next section. Now, I want you to realize the internet is a network of networks. It is all around the world. We all have access to it at all points. If you could see them, they can see you. As such, you need to be aware that espionage is a thing, and there are organizations all around the world, including private organizations, criminal organizations, state-affiliated groups, and others that are going to try to compromise your organization to steal data, okay? Anybody who's dealing with intellectual property, whether they be, for example, building things, making things, or anybody who's dealing with personal information, payroll, or anybody dealing with financial information, like retail firms, hotels, are going to be susceptible to this. And we're seeing this in a lot of ways and continuing to grow. Perpetrators and victims are often on opposite sides of the world. And it's important to remember that the borders of the United States do not apply to the internet. Okay. You know, you could have a company here in beautiful Big Bear Lake, California, and you could be compromised by a person, again, halfway around the world, in a country where our laws do not apply. Okay. A lot of these attacks will occur through email attachments. They could be a web drive-by. They could be installing some sort of malicious code on your computer. It could be somebody having code on a USB stick and sticking it into a computer or server inside your network. It's important that you keep your systems up to date, you follow antivirus best practices, you train your users, log actions, and more. Let me go ahead and give you two examples of recent things that have occurred over the last couple of years to kind of illustrate this issue of espionage. There's a company based in Florida called Aginal. They're a US-based company, and they've created or are working on creating a process to turn algae from the sea into clean burning fuel. Kind of cool if you think about it. Okay. So they've created this process. This process takes something that organically is created, automatically created, and is a nuisance. Algae, they can take this, okay, from the ocean and essentially through a chemical process, create clean burning fuel. So if you think about that, the implications of this are incredible. I think it's something like 60% of the world lives, you know, within an hour or so of the ocean. So, I mean, this has huge implications. Okay. So a couple years ago, they noticed that their internet speed was slowing down. They noticed that their computers were unresponsive, and they started doing an investigation, and they noticed that a random connection was being initiated to a video conferencing camera that they had in their conference room originating in China. Digging further, they found that the hackers had attempted to compromise their network over 39 million times just in the previous couple of months. So they have this a conferencing device inside of their network that they use for video conferencing with the clients and staff and vendors probably all over the world. It was something that was connected to the internet. And by essentially attacking this, what they were attempting to do is compromise that and then be able to leapfrog into other devices inside of the network. You know, admittedly, what they said there, policies were security through obscurity, meaning, you know, they created things that were just a little bit more complicated rather than implement, you know, standard security protocols like OAuth 2 or encryption like AES 256. You know, they thought that, hey, maybe we're going to keep a low profile and people won't know about you. Okay. That's just not the case anymore. If you're connected to the internet, trust me, they know about you and they will find you. And that's a pretty common occurrence with a lot of organizations that just don't think that, you know, what they have is of importance or of value to other people. If you're dealing with something that can be financially sold, bought, you know, packaged, whatever, well, I mean, somebody is interested and somebody wants to get it. And if you have devices connected to on the internet, people will be able to find you. Let me go ahead and show you kind of a cool resource here. This is a website called Shodan, Shodan.io, and it's essentially a search engine. And we have search engines for a lot of different things. If I don't know where to go to eat tonight, well, I can pull out Google Maps or I can pull out Yelp and I can find a recommendation. If I don't know something, I can go to Google and find it that way. If I want to find somebody, I can use social media. Well, Shodan is a search engine for connected devices on the internet, and it allows us to be able to find things and understand how networks are connected. It's a pretty cool solution. You can check it out yourself. You could put in your IP address. You can put in your company name, and you could see the different things that might pop up on your network. So, for example, if I search for a particular company, let's go ahead and just pick on Hilton hotels as an example here. This will search. Oh, good news. There's nothing there. Let's try that again. Let's try, let's go ahead and search for Windows. Okay. If we go ahead and we search for different devices such as Windows on the network, it will essentially pop up and tell us where different Windows devices are located. And so if we just search generically for Windows, we could see that there are 2.5 million different Windows devices connected to the internet. And we could drill down. We can go by individual, country and then ultimately state and city. Now, let's just pick on this top result right here. Okay, we can see that this IP address, and I don't know who these people are, we could see, because the operating system will typically tell you what it is remotely, we could see that it's running Windows 2008 R2. You know, and if we click inside of this particular device itself, we can see the different ports that are open. We can see it's a web server. We can see that it's got, for example, Nginx running, which is a web server application. We can see that it's got some other remote commands that are supported by this. And we can essentially go down here and get a little bit of information about this computer. Now, let me just ask you objectively, okay, at the time of this recording, it is 2021. Do you think a Windows operating system that was made in roughly 2007, you know, so more than 10 years ago, almost 15 years ago, is still secure this amount of time later? The answer is probably not, you know, so people can find this information. They know this. You know, we can put in an IP address and we can see what computers are essentially being advertised on that network. And that's how these organizations get compromised. For example, if we just search for the words default password, we'll come up with a number of different resources where the passwords might be default. In this particular example here, let's look at this guy. Cisco configuration. We know this to be a router of some sort. Well, it's literally telling us what the default passwords are. And unfortunately, a number of people never bothered to change them. So likewise, we could search for other unsecure technologies, for example, FTP. Okay, well, here are a number of different FTP services that are running that could be susceptible to techniques such as brute force or password manipulation that could potentially be compromised. And I know this, attackers know this, you should know this as well. So definitely check out Shodan. It's a pretty cool resource to understand essentially where your exposure might be. Now, another more common type of attack is what's called a distributed denial of a service attack. Okay. A distributed denial of a service attack is where we overwhelm a network with so much traffic that it becomes unusable. Okay. Now, this particular attack can be applicable to anybody, but it's really applicable to more organizations that are online based. You know, they either have applications that have customers that, you know, essentially are using the web for the fundamental nature of their organization. The attacks can last from minutes to days, but they can have huge consequences. Essentially, we send so much traffic, fake traffic. It's not customer traffic. A good amount of traffic to your company's website is fantastic. But if your website is designed to hold, you know, maybe 500 people a day and you get 5 million people a day, well, guess what? There's so much it becomes unusable and normal customers can't access it. Essentially floods the network so that no work can be done. This particular type of attack is very pervasive and it can happen seemingly instantly and it can happen from minutes to days at a time. Usually the attackers will use what we call a botnet army of zombie computers. I know that sounds crazy, to flood it to the point that that company, that website, that service, that platform is completely unusable. Additionally, it can also cause fraud. I've seen this, for example, occur with organizations that do telecommunications, like phone calls, you know, that manage like, phone systems. I had this happen early in my career where the phone system was compromised and almost instantly they caused so much traffic that, and instituted calls, you know, to Africa that rung up like a $5,000 phone bill overnight to that particular client. You know, so I mean, it can be very damaging to that organization. And it can also be part of a larger attack. Okay. So here's an example. This was for a company called Ascent Builders. Okay. They're a big construction company based here in the United States. And this attack occurred in 2012. So in 2012, attackers started moving out of money out of this company's bank accounts. Well, at the same time, they also hit the bank with a large DDoS attack, essentially taking the bank's online banking system offline. The hackers were able to access Ascent's accounts. They transferred money to 62 other individual accounts around the country and international through the ACH wire system, each of these transactions being between $4,000 and $100,000. Okay. At the same time, the Ascent company was hit with a Trojan malware, which prevented them from being able to access the bank's website. And ultimately, they were not able to recover most of the money that was compromised. So in this particular instance, what we're looking at here is that we're seeing that attacks can be a combination of different things. It could, for example, be a malware attack in combination with a DDoS attack and combination with other attacks on the user's network, which essentially prevent different devices from being able to connect. Well, in this particular instance, you know, the CFO, the controller probably couldn't get online, couldn't use their machine. At this point, 2012, probably the bank didn't have a mobile app. You know, the bank probably wasn't as prepared as they should have been. Well, ultimately, you know, money was taken and compromised, you know, but through these different levels of attack, they ultimately achieved what they needed. So even though a DDoS might not be something susceptible to your specific company, just realize it can be brought in for a larger attack. It could be a component of that. All right, let's go ahead and have our next review question. A good and effective description of malware would be unwanted emails in your inbox. Nope. That's spam. Targeted phone calls and text messages from people claiming to be from the IRS. No, that would also be spam, but in this case with phone calls and text messages. I actually just right prior to this broadcast got a notice that my car warranty had expired. So if anybody needs a hot lead on a car warranty, I'm your guy. Is it overwhelmingly amount of network traffic which negatively affects a server's performance? No, it is not. The correct answer here would be a term inclusive of all malicious code and programs. So anything kind of negative, anything kind of nasty would be the term that we would use for malware. Alrighty. So we've got about 10 minutes left. Let's go ahead and just finish with a couple of general security recommendations. We will explore these different recommendations in future podcasts, diving deep, for example, into different services such as anti-malware solutions, firewall, things of this nature, but just to kind of wet your beak with respect to some different devices that you need. Now, I want to just remind you, my best security recommendations. You need to deal with security at a policy level inside the organization. You cannot trust users to make good and consistent decisions about security. It's not that they willingly will try to get you breached or compromised. It's just most people work self-interestedly, and they're just going to do what is ever in their best interest overall. Security has to be applied uniformly from the CEO to the intern. You can't have a little bit of security. That idea of security through obscurity is really dangerous inside of an organization. This idea that, oh, we're just some small mom and pop shop, that's really dangerous. That can hurt your organization and ultimately bite you in the end. So when you're setting up security inside your company, please just be aware it has to go from the CEO to the intern. Everybody plays by the same set of rules. It's always best to deal with this at a policy level so that essentially you have standard practices. I personally would recommend that you build this into your employee handbook. What are your security best practices? And require your employees as a condition of employment to follow them. In future podcasts, we're going to dive into designing security policies for your organization. There's a wonderful resource called the SANS Institute that you've probably heard me talk about before. It's sans.org if you'd like to jump ahead and take a look at it, where we can use a lot of their fundamental security policies, which they offer for free, to supplement or augment our employee handbook. And we're going to dive into some of those policies in the future, giving you some insight on why you might want to choose some of those for your company. And lastly, my best practice is if you don't know this stuff, if you don't live and breathe security, don't try to do it on your own. Find folks that can essentially help you implement this inside your organization. Knowing what you not know can be very deadly to the organization. Now, in terms of software hardware, I strongly recommend some sort of antivirus, anti-malware. The more inclusive term is anti-malware now, which essentially provide comprehensive security at the computer level, server level, that will help ensure that if you're Computer gets malware of some sort. It's identified and removed. Lots of different options with respect to what anti-malware you might want. And I'd recommend you check out the website AVTest. AVTest.org is a independent evaluation of anti-malware solutions that does this regularly, I think every month, testing these different services to determine their effectiveness. Now, if you're asking for my personal opinion would be Trend Micro. I've always been a big fan of Trend Micro. They've treated me well over the years, and it has worked really well for me. Other best practices you might want to consider, certainly having good and strong passwords. Passwords are often our first and only line of defense. Having a good, strong password can be the difference of whether or not your system is compromised. Okay, having a good, strong lock, good, strong encryption like AES 256, which is in a lot of ways our standard security practice now, is great, but you have to pair it with a good password as well. So I would strongly recommend that. And you might also want to consider utilizing a password manager, which can also be quite effective as well. A password manager can be very useful because it will keep all of your different passwords, it will keep them organized, and will even generate those long and complex passwords for you. Whenever possible, you should consider utilizing multi-factor authentication, MFA. MFA is an additional security method above and beyond passwords inside of your computer or your service or your website or your bank, that if your password is stolen or compromised, well, another measure of security is required in order to be able to access that account. What's great about this is that if your password is stolen through no fault of your own, through another data breach for another company, and they get access, for example, to the password you use for your bank, well, if your bank requires you to also put in a PIN code that is texted to you, well, guess what? Unless that attacker also stole your phone, they're not going to be able to access your account. And so that's why MFA is so effective, because it will add another layer of security that almost effectively eliminates the risk of somebody being able to compromise it. And so there are three different multi-factor approaches: something you know, such as a password or PIN, and that's what we do normally. There's something you have, which is typically a text message sent to a smartphone. And we can also use something you are, such as biometric, which is increasingly becoming more useful using services such as Windows Hello on your computer, or, you know, Face ID from your iPhone, or Touch ID on your iPhone as well. Now, the last thing I want to mention is the importance of utilizing a good modern security focused browser. My personal preference is Google Chrome and Edge, which actually, for all intents and purposes, are like 99% the same thing these days. Edge, the latest version, which is brought by Microsoft, effectively is built on Chromium, which is the standard browser that Chrome is built on. And these browsers are so much more effective than pretty much anything else that existed before. They have a ton of different functionalities that will often provide advanced security and identity protection right inside the browser itself. And one of the other things I like about these is the fact that they also have a variety of different third-party tools that can extend the browser beyond its additional functionality. You know, think about your iPhone or your Android. You know, you've got the App Store or the Google Play Marketplace where you can go and get additional apps and services. Well, Chrome and Edge are essentially the same thing. They have their own little marketplace where you can get your own third-party tools. And the one that I really recommend that I think adds a ton of value is uBlock Origin. Okay. In a nutshell, uBlock Origin blocks all third-party resources such as ads, malicious code, tracking services from even being loaded on the web page you visit. Now, the reason I like this is that, I mean, frankly, the browser is a tool that most of us have open almost all day, every day. And so many of the resources that we're using are web-based. So utilizing, for example, uBlock Origin is fantastic, not only because it will, for example, eliminate or significantly reduce ads and other tracking services, you know, that come from services like Google or Facebook, but it also does a great job of blocking potentially malicious code. It enhances and secures your browser by adding additional privacy, preventing unwanted and potentially malicious things from infecting your computer. And by default, it protects you on all websites, but you can also selectively turn it off as needed. It's a free tool available for Chrome, Firefox, Edge, Opera, and some other major browsers as well. And if you're interested in this, check out this particular website. But in my opinion, I think just having this will do such a good job of reducing your risk that it's a no-brainer. And I think every single person should use uBlock Origin or similar tools like it. This is the one I like the most because it's open source, it's got a great reputation, and it's available on all the browsers that I regularly use. Last thing, you can't go wrong. Keep your devices up to date. If you only did one thing, keep your devices up to date. If we look at malware, it almost always exclusively targets old, out-of-date devices running old software. Keeping your devices up to date will certainly help you above and beyond pretty much any other method. When security updates come available, go ahead and put them on your computer as quickly as possible. Alrighty, let's have our final review question. Alrighty. So which devices should be regularly updated? Is it networks, routers, switches, and hotspots? You betcha, absolutely all network appliances. Network printers? Yes, absolutely. Printers themselves can still be compromised and they can serve as a leapfrog, as I like to say, from one device to the other. And often they typically have less security than, like, for example, the latest edition of Linux or the latest edition of Windows Server. It's easier to compromise. So if I can get into that device, once I'm in, it might be easier to get to other devices in the network. So certainly printers and all other devices as well. What about my computer, network, servers, and other devices? Absolutely, you should do those as well. And the correct answer here is everything. Everything should be updated as frequently as possible. Okay, so let's do a quick summary. What did we learn today? Well, today we learned about common security breach techniques and practices, and we talked through some of the major ones, including, for example, point of sale, physical theft and loss, privilege misuse, web applications and attacks, SQL injection, the risk of errors, cyber espionage, and more. We also reviewed a couple of best practices around applications, platform, and other hardware and software to help keep your organization secure. Now, we're going to continue this service and continue this series. There's so much more that we can learn in the realm of data protection for our organization. And in future courses, I really want to pull apart that DBIR report, that data breach investigation report. I feel like there's so much we can learn and look at the specific risks for our industry and professions. So we're going to take a deeper look at that report in the future. And we're also going to dive deeper into best practices, really kind of pulling apart different anti-malware, antivirus solutions, what they are, and how we can effectively use them in our company. Well, so let's go ahead and wrap up. Before we go, I do want to remind you that if you are a financial professional, you can earn a CPE credit for watching or listening to today's podcast. I know. So go ahead and head on over to cpetoday.com. Use course code IDT2. You'll take a quick short 5-question exam. It'll take you 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes, maybe even 2 minutes. You're all smart people. I don't think you'll have any problems with it about what we discussed here today. After you complete the short quiz, you can print out a certificate, hang it on your wall if you'd like, and you will be one more credit closer to maintaining your professional license. So go ahead, please check out cpetoday.com. Use course code IDT2. If you liked today's podcast, and I hope you did, please consider connecting with us on social media. You can find us on almost all social media channels as CPE Today. Please feel free to follow us. Let us know what you like. If you have any particular ideas for content, I'm always looking for new material to cover. And you can always listen to us on your schedule. We tend to podcast live twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays at 11 o'clock, but you can also listen to us on demand on the platform of your choosing. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Podcasts, and others. We would absolutely love if you'd leave a comment on our social media or a comment on one of our platforms here, or if you really like us, maybe consider leaving us a review. We're a growing business. Any and all help would be greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for your time and interest for today. I appreciate you attending. On behalf of myself and everybody else with CP Today, thank you so much for your time and attention, and we look forward to seeing you in another podcast soon. Best wishes and good luck.